Okay, so thanks for coming. So just to motivate this for some of the people that aren't biologists or work primarily on microbes, I think there's two reasons that evolutionary biologists care about selection arising from sexual interactions, which most people just think of as sexual selection. The first and the sort of oldest reason that people really cared about is because it's directly responsible for many of the really dramatic and rapidly evolving secondary sexual traits, peacock tails, behaviors towards potential mates. But one of my main interests, which is also sort of a long-standing interest of many people, is that it indirectly affects the strength of selection, I would argue, on most genes. That there are general effects, and as a consequence, there are general effects on rates of adaptation and purging. And this is a very, very old idea. It goes back to Darwin, in fact, before Darwin, that essentially the healthy males are the ones that have the greatest siring success. And because most genes affect health in some way, shape, or form, they get brought in under the umbrella of things that are influenced by sexual selection. And so from that view, then it sort of leads to this conjecture that for most mutations, sexual selection operates in the same direction as natural selection. And caveat that, of course, there are these sexually antagonistic alleles that are really important and really interesting. There's now quite a lot of evidence for them that contribute to standing variation. But for the typical mutation, the conjecture is that selection actually acts in the same direction on males and females. And because sexual selection is so strong on males, there's this great competition for males for mates, that you end up having stronger selection through males than you do through females.
I missed the first minute, so maybe you said it, but what's your definition of natural selection?
As opposed to sexual selection?
Well, sexual selection is just part of natural selection. I mean, I guess so it's the same direction as natural selection.
Sure, you can think it. I largely agree with you. In the evolutionary biology literature, they distinguish between those two.
They're
words. And I think of it as selection. One could view it as selection through females and selection as males. Sexual selection is often defined as the part of selection that's getting reproductive success, that's getting mates.
But this point about the direction is that different parts of the life cycle might select for phenotypes in different directions.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. So, to me, one of the aspects of sexual selection is there's by changing the mating systems or intensifying the competition for mates, you could affect selection genome-wide. Okay, so while that conjecture has existed for a long time, I don't think there was that much in the way of direct evidence for it. So this is one of the pieces of evidence for it. In flies, if you go and picks a handful of phenotypic markers and ask what's the selection on them through juvenile survival, through female fecundity, and through adult male mating success, which I've just called sexual selection here, you tend to see that a result is consistent with conjecture that selection is typically in the same direction for males and females, and that it's stronger through males.
Just to make sure I understand, the traits are ticked off on the horizontal axis. And males and females are separated?
So this is for a handful of genes, so eight genes in flies, phenotypic mutations, and the white bar is viability selection, then this is an estimate of fecundity selection, and this is a measure of sexual selection done in two different densities.
And there's no separation for male and female?
The sexual selection is the adult male mating, is sort of, you can think of it as selection through adult male fitness, and fecundity selection is adult female fitness.
I see. Thank you.
Okay, so that's for these sort of very special set of phenotypic mutations. You can do the same thing with spontaneous mutations. So this is a set of chromosomes that have accumulated mutations spontaneously in a mutation accumulation experiment. You can look at those chromosomes, how they affect male fitness and how they affect female fitness, and they're there's a positive correlation between the two, and the effects tend to be about 50% larger in males than they are in females. So again, evidence for this statement that I started with, that typical mutations affect males and females in the same direction, and selection tends to be stronger for
males.
How
is male fitness measured? I guess I'm just not real sure what is.
So in these assays, what you're doing is you're taking simple version of it is you take males and you compete them against a competitor for access to females, and what you're looking at is the how many offspring are sired by the focal males relative to the competitor males.
Then when you plot, if you can go back to the previous slide, so this is male fitness relative to some other population, some other.
Yeah, so it's against a competitor. So you have an ancestral chromosome that has not accumulated mutations,
yeah.
And you compete it against a competitor stock. And then you take each of your mutation accumulation lines and compete them against the competitor stock.
So these are deleterious mutations.
Yes, like these are spontaneous mutations. Most spontaneous mutations that have any effect on fitness, of course, tend to be deleterious. So on average, they reduce male fitness relative to that ancestral line that hasn't accumulated mutations. Okay. And we do females in exactly the same kind of assay, but the focal individuals there, of course, are just the females rather than the males.
It's mutation accumulation without selection during the time of.
That's right. So they accumulate mutations in this. The way we do these mutation, this particular mutation accumulation experiment, you're tracking a specific chromosome, taking a single chromosome across each generation. So selection should be very weak relative to drift. So in other words, you should be, everything except for sort of near lethal should be accumulating at the neutral rate, or close to the neutral rate. Okay. So that's, evidence that sexual selection, in other words, adult male fitness, the effects on adult male fitness tend to be in the same direction as for females. So loosely speaking, we'd say natural selection tend to be in the same direction, and that this selection through males is particularly strong. And so sexual selection should accelerate natural adaptation, so accelerate adaptation, accelerate purging. And so what other people have done is attempted to test this in a different way by doing what I refer to as the monogamy versus polygamy regime. So they do this because by doing enforced monogamy, you largely prevent sexual selection from happening. Right? Males don't differ in the number of mates they get. They're all forced to have a single mate. And so the idea is, if this is true, that if natural selection or sexual selection aids natural selection for most genes, then you should see faster adaptation or faster purging. When you do these experimental evolution studies where you do enforced monogamy versus polygamy.
So do I understand correctly, if you had enforced monogamy for a system of peacocks, the large tail would go away in time?
Yeah, assuming there's a cost to the peacock tail.
Yep.
But yeah, right. So I mean, the idea is sort of even walking back a step from that is if you do enforced monogamy, it doesn't matter if you have a big tail or a small tail, you all get one mate, right? So if you if there's underlying genes that sort of affect the overall health of an individual, and actually tail size and color and display depends on that, then you're taking all that selection away when you do enforced monogamy.
But if you could also have monogamy, could you not, where you want to, if you're monogamous, but you want to select the most fertile female?
Yeah, so you still have the selection on Oh, I see the male selectors. Is
yes.
that what you're saying?
Yes.
Right, so this is enforced monogamy where you randomly pair a male with a female, so no opportunity for that, essentially. Okay. So, So people have attempted to do this by doing this monogamy versus polygamy paradigm, and there's now a bunch of studies that have done this, and the results are really mixed. So here's two examples. This is an example from Calabrucus sea beetles, and they found faster adaptation with polygamy than they do under monogamy. And here's an experiment in Drosophila serrata, a relative of the more famous Drosophila melanogaster. And in this case, they manipulated both the presence and absence of fecundity selection, as well as the presence and absence of sexual selection through males. But I just want to focus on the latter part of the manipulation with and without sexual selection. And they did not find any evidence that you had faster improvement as they were adapting to a new larval diet. There was no faster improvement when you included sexual selection.
And these fitnesses are in percentages?
I'm not sure what they're in, but the point is these bars are not higher than those bars.
I understand that's the point. I'm just curious how you get a selection coefficient of 35.
These aren't selection coefficients. These are sort of absolute fitness, so they're probably something like number of offspring produced.
Okay. Make sure that the traits under sexual selection there was relaxed selection of those traits.
No, I mean all they've done is they've done enforced monogamy. Yeah. So you maintain your populations. It's really laborious, right? Because you have to maintain your population by isolating, you randomly choose males and females and pair them together. So if you want to have a population size of 200, you know, that's 100 pairs of males and females, and that's your monogamy population, and then your polygamy population you're mixing. That's all you're doing. Just a simple manipulation of whether you have the opportunity for sexual selection to occur or not.
But why don't you look if there is a relaxation on the traits that are under sexual selection?
In many cases, people don't know what the traits are that are under sexual selection, right? So, you know, if there were peacock tails, you could go and measure them. But, you know, for example, in Calabrucus, they don't really know. In the case of Drosophila serrata, they know some of the things, like the cuticular hydrocarbons that are involved, but that's probably only, even in the peacock case, that's, you know, we know one trait particularly well that everybody knows, but there's probably other traits as well. But in any case, no, they haven't gone and done and looked at that. It's just a sort of first order thing of, we're going to do this crude manipulation and see what happens. So the point is the results are quite mixed, and so to me, the question then is why, when there are there's this set of studies, depending on how you define them, 10 or more studies, and they give quite mixed results. And the first reason to me was this, was that in all these kinds of experiments, you're looking at very short-term evolutionary responses, at least short-term compared to what the microbial people do. And so you're getting response from standing variation. And the standing variation might be, can easily be enriched for sexually antagonistic alleles. So those alleles that I brushed aside on the second or third slide, they probably play an important role in shaping standing variation. And if the response is from standing variation, then it's not too too surprising that sexual selection may not help natural selection if what's in the standing variation is enriched for sexual antagonism.
But why should that be the case? I mean, is there some reason to expect that it's enriched?
In the sense of, in cases where for mutations where selection's in the same direction in males and females, those alleles should be not very variable in a population, right? Because selection is pushing them either to fixation or to loss, and they're not maintained polymorphic, where as opposed to alleles that are under sexual antagonism, it's possible that they're under stable balanced polymorphism, or at least there's the conflicting selection so that they can wander around more before they... So initially when these experiments started happening, this was my way to to rationalize the observation that we weren't seeing this faster response. And so a simpler test would be, let's do this experiment again where you're not sort of just relying on whatever's in the standing variation, but do an even simpler experiment where you look at purging of known deleterious mutations. And so that's the experiment that Howard Rundle and Devin Arbuthnot did, again, in Drosophila melanogaster. So they did this experiment with just six phenotypic marker mutations, where they start the allele at 70% or something, and they look at the rate at which it declines over 10 generations under enforced monogamy or polygamy, which again they describe as manipulations of the presence or absence of sexual selection. And so again, these were phenotypically the same types of mutations that we had studied before, where we saw stronger selection through males and through females, and the direction of selection was typically the same. When Howard first told me he was doing this experiment, I thought it was kind of pointless because I knew what was going to happen, that you'd get rid of them faster when you have sexual selection. And in fact, that's not what he saw. So he did not find that these mutations were eliminated more quickly when sexual selection had the opportunity to occur. And so the question...
different in terms of nature from the ones you had? Yours were...
They were not the same mutations, but they were the same, get them from the stock center, they have some big phenotypic effect. So I had no reason to believe they did to be different.
Yours were from mutation accumulation lines?
I did both. So the very first slide I showed you with the bar graph, those were phenotypic marker mutations from the stock center that we'd introgressed. And then the second thing I showed you, the scatter plot, were mutation accumulation lines. So he got this result that was, to me, very counterintuitive. And so why did he get this result? And so to understand why he got this result, why do we expect this result? So again, just a cartoon model of selections. So we expect total selection, total selection is the average selection through females and males. And under monogamy, the selection on females under monogamy, we can think of that as the selection that occurs through the juvenile stage and the selection through on female adult female fecundity. And for males, it's just the selection on juveniles under monogamy because we've essentially eliminated any selection in the adult phase. And under polygamy, we get the same thing for females. And under males, we add this extra component of sexual selection. That's what I refer to as the classic view. I think that's the way most people were thinking of these experiments. And so under this sort of very simple way to think about it, the total selection under polygamy should be greater than the total selection under monogamy because the selection in males and under polygamy is greater than the selection under males under monogamy, and the selection in females is the same. That was the way we viewed things. But maybe the reason experiments like the one Howard did that I just told you about, the reason that it doesn't come out the way we expected it, because this assumption that the selection in females is the same under both these conditions, maybe that is incorrect. And so I want to do a slight detour to explain why this might not be the case. So probably the biggest paradigm shift in the way people think about sexual interactions and sexual selection over the last 30 years has been the recognition of this idea of sexual conflict. So in many systems, males gain fitness by mating more than females. By mating more than other males, and females don't. Females don't get more get more fitness as they mate more. Bateman, it goes back to Bateman. And as a consequence of this, males often evolve morphologies and behaviors that increase their mating success relative to other males, but often these can be inadvertently harmful to females. So that's the male harm part. Males essentially want to mate more frequently than the females do, and that results in this conflict over mating rate, and that can lead to all kinds of interesting coevolution between males and females. But what I really want to focus on here is this part here, is that males inadvertently evolve to harm females. They're being selected to outcompete other males, but if, as a byproduct, they harm females, that's something that can happen and does happen. And in Drosophila, it's known from work by people like Bill Rice, who's here today, and also Tracy Chapman and Linda Partridge and others, that females kept continuous exposure to males, they die faster and are less produce less offspring, and that harm, in, at least in flies, occurs both through physical interactions and also by manipulation with seminal products. Okay, so let's returning back to this puzzle. Why does that matter here? Okay, so why would these things not be the same? Okay, so the insight into this came from Tristan Long and Bill Rice, and they made the following points, that, as I just told you, males harass and harm females, but males don't do this in an unbiased way. Males preferentially harm and harass the best females, and that sort of makes sense intuitively, and they showed it experimentally. And that by harming the best females, the intrinsically best females, they drag down their fitness. And that's illustrated in these experiments they did here. So this is the fecundity of large females and the versus the fecundity of small females in a context where males don't get to choose between large or small females. When males, if you put large and small females together in the same container with males, so males have the opportunity to direct their harm and harassment, they preferentially harm and harass those good females, the intrinsically best females, and that harm that they cause drags their fitness down. And because they're busy bothering the best females, that frees the other females from harm and harassment, and their fitness goes up. So if you think about this in terms of what this would mean in terms of selection, if males don't get to choose, there would be a selective difference between these large and small females of about 0.3, and that drops down to 0.1. So this is, to me, a really, really important effect. When I first heard of the idea, I thought, oh, that's kind of a nice idea, but I thought the effect was probably not that big. But these are really dramatic effects on the strength of selection. It's not some weak second-order thing. It's a big effect on what
So these are with sex ratios that are realistic?
Yes.
What are sex ratios?
50-50.
Okay, they are.
Yeah. Or at least that's how we keep them in these lab populations. Okay. So there's only two those experimental evolution studies in the monogamy versus polygamy paradigm, only two studies have actually gone back to try and unpack what's going on there. And both of them are ones that Howard did. One was in this one that I told you about with the deleterious mutations. And he indeed found this thing where the males basically don't harm and harass the mutant females. And so but they do harm and harass the wild type ones when they have a choice. And so that brings down the selective advantage of the wild type relative to the mutants. So that's potentially explaining what's going on here. And then in his other experiment where this was an adaptation experiment from standing variation where they were adapting to a larval medium, he went and looked at this issue in those flies, and he found this dramatic effect, again, where he did this kind of thing. When males have no opportunity to choose between large and small females, there's a huge difference, 40% difference in fitness, and that goes to zero. It completely eradicates the selective difference between large and small females. So this is a really big effect. males are harming and harassing the high-quality females, and this reduces the average advantage of those females, weakening selection, reducing rates of adaptation and purging, and maybe explaining a lot of these experimental results.
In that last example, there is no harm to the female, to the best female. Yeah, it's the same.
So what you would really the best result you would hope for was these things to come together, right?
For you to make that harm, there must be competition between the female.
Yeah, sure, right. So, but I think what you're saying is the most intuitive result would be that these bars come together. I agree. Of course, there are error bars on all these things. I think the experiments that Bill did really, I only sort of showed you the main result, but they really sort of unpacked what's going on there.
I'm just saying that there could be sexual selection through the female side.
Sure. Yeah.
I think the point, well, for the males are can the females choose the males?
In some limited, they can.
They
accept a mate or they don't accept a mate. They can struggle. They can do all these things.
But they can't choose not to have males harassing.
Yeah, they can't choose males not to have. Yeah.
Is your point that there doesn't seem to be any decrease in fitness for large females?
That's right. I mean, I think that's what his point was. That's
the point.
You know, as opposed to the cleanest example that I showed you here, right? That these things come together, right? So in this study, they didn't go and try and understand behaviorally what's going on. In Bill's study, they did. And I'll show you some other data where we did also. But at the very least, you can see the larger thing is there's a selective difference here of 40%, and the point estimate of selection here is basically zero. Right? So there's questions of the detailed mechanisms of why, behavioral mechanisms of why, but this is clearly evidence that selection is quite different with male choice versus without. Okay. So what I want to talk to you about is work that I've done in collaboration with Howard. Right, so we started with this view, and so the updated view is that actually selection under monogamy and polygamy is quite different, and so maybe the reason that you don't get this the expected results when you do these monogamy versus polygamy experiments is because while selection on males under polygamy might be greater than it is on males under monogamy, the reverse might be true for females.
So just sorry, if I understand these are short-term studies, but is there any intuition on long-time scale whether this would hold up? Because, it seems detrimental to males also.
It's not necessarily, so we talked about this a bit the other day, but it's not, so the harm part that males cause isn't necessarily detrimental to males, right? So if a male in trying to get access to a female injures her, but actually mates with her.
Yeah, but if he gets killed by another male, then that's zero fitness, right? I mean,
In the case where.
I mean, they're fighting each other, right? Somebody loses, so he may end up mating with nobody. So, I can see that on the short time scale, yes, this will work, but on long time scales, does it somehow equilibrate and does that effect goes away? Or?
I don't think so. I think you can have male harm persisting. You can go outside and watch mallard ducks where the males will drown the females in attempts to mating them. There's my favorite example are bed bugs, but bed bugs mate by what's called traumatic insemination. Males grab and stab females to inject them. They stab them through the cuticle. And in fact, it's so bad, people basically can't keep bed bugs in culture in the lab because they will drive populations extinct. But clearly, that's the way they normally reproduce, in natural populations.
So in the wild, they kill the female, but the female gives birth first? Or?
No, they don't. They inject them. The problem is if you have too many matings, then yeah, you die. But
and
under
everybody,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
So is the female harm mainly pre-mating, or is it post-mating?
I think it depends a lot on the context in which you do it. So, for example, the post-mating harm, the manipulation by accessory gland protein, the work by Tracy Chapman and Mariana Wolfner and others, that's mostly known as a harm story, but Tracy's also shown that actually under other contexts that it's not so harmful at all. So I think it depends on exactly how you do it. And that's kind of where I'm going. So these sexual interactions, I think, can broadly affect the way selection works in both adaptation and purging. And we might be able to imagine cases in the wild or manipulate cases in the lab where we can turn up or down the extent to which flies are interacting in a particular way. And so, as I said, most of this work has been done in flies, and we typically keep flies in situations like this. They're relatively high-density, simple environments, and other environments are lower density and, I think importantly, spatially more complex. And so we think this difference might be really important, because when you have this sexual conflict plays a really big part in this, and sexual conflict occurs much more easily in environments like this. If you watch flies in a vial, you see males harassing females almost relentlessly. And females don't really have much of an opportunity to escape from that harm and harassment, whereas in principle, in an environment like this, they can fly away and potentially find a site where there's maybe less harassment, not necessarily no harassment, but less harassment.
Is that the food source in the bottom of the vial?
Yes, yeah. Okay, so what we did was, we took sort of what I call one micro step toward the apple orchard, and we made these environments like this that are physically larger, and they have more spatial complexity. I think importantly that these multiple food patches, which is really important for the way flies interact. And essentially the idea was, by changing these environments, that the thought was that we'd be able to dial down the level of male harassment, and so that you don't have this dramatic weakening of selection for females that I showed you prior, and so that you might be able to reap the benefits of sexual selection without without a concomitant reduction in the strength of selection through females. And so that's what I'm going to focus on, is how we can change the selection through females. I should say there's probably also a difference in the way selection occurs through males as well in these environments. It's probably harder for males, there's probably greater selection on males in environments like this than there is in that. And I think that's also going on as well. And we're doing some experiments on that, but I won't talk about that today. Okay, so as I said, what I want to talk to you about first is, by doing this very, very simple change in the environment, can we manipulate the way selection occurs through females? And this is the work of our shared graduate student, Li Yan. Okay, so first I want to tell you a little bit about of some more behavioral kind of work. And so this first experiment was to test the extent to which males are harming and harassing large and small females. I should say in these experiments we use a larval rearing manipulation to create large and small females as kind of a phenocopy of a way of individuals with good and bad genotypes. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to create large and small females and put them in vials with males in either these vials or these more complex containers. And this is what we see. So this is the number of sexual interactions directed towards small or large females in these vials versus in these cages. And you see see sort of a dramatic difference between these two environments. First of all, the overall number of interactions is smaller in cages than in vials, but more importantly, there's this big difference in who it's directed towards, right? So in the vials, you have a lot more interactions directed towards large females, as Bill saw, but that completely goes away in the cages, and there's no differences. And we can also look and see how often are we seeing females eating yeast, which is their primary food. And in the vials, these large females are getting, presumably because they're getting harassed so much, you don't see them eating very often. But in the cages, you see them eating a lot. Whereas for the small females, it doesn't seem to affect them that much.
And the males are independent of arena, is there?
Yeah, we have the same type of males in both arenas. So,
just wondered if they would stick still. You can imagine that they would eat different rates. If they're running around after the females all the time.
Oh, the males. Yeah. So we didn't watch what the males do, but the males don't, the adult males don't actually eat very much.
In either environment.
That's right.
And you took large males or small males?
The males were large males, I think, if I remember correctly. But it's the same kind of males in both. Okay, so the second thing was just this, can we see effects of harm? And so we do this 2x2 design, so either in vials or in cages. And we do a manipulation where females are kept with males continuously. Whoops, I got a timer on, I think. Where they only have a brief, limited exposure to males, just enough exposure to ensure that they're not sperm limited or anything. So this is just to ask, is there harm caused by being forced to hang around with males all the time? And the answer is yes. So this is in the female fecundity or survival kinds of fecundity. When they have low exposure versus high exposure in vials, so there's this big effect of exposure to males, and that goes almost completely away.
So the size of the female is one sexually selected trait? Because regarding my question that I asked earlier,
yeah.
When you enforce monogamy, so do you have the female that decreases then in size after so many generations?
So we don't think that the female size is primarily under selection in the sense of the large females lay more eggs. And then as a secondary effect on that, males are preferentially trying to mate with those females because they're more, presumably because they're more fecund.
So it's a sexually selected trait.
You could call it that. I mean, I don't think that's the sort of typical language people would use for it, but.
Did anyone ever look them in enforced monogamy or polygamy, whether they were different in size of the
females? Not to my knowledge. It would be hard to totally reverse the direction of selection on fecundity because you need to be large in order to pump out eggs. So it's almost like a physical constraint.
So you're going to interpret these results about the...
How would you like me to interpret
them? I'm just curious. I mean, like if they mate more with the small females because they don't have what they like, so they mate with whatever is better kind of thing, or...
If you're at so in the I think the way the interactions work in these cages is the males probably spend most of their time hanging around the food, and the females come down into the food because that's where they have to go to eat and to lay eggs, and so so I think males try and mate with whoever's down there.
Okay. And behaviorally, having looked whether males are more mobile in one environment versus another?
I mean, it's very, very hard to do that in the sense of, I can tell you that in the cages, you tend to, it's more obvious that the males are hanging around the food. And in the vials, they're kind of moving around. It's a small space, and they're kind of moving around all over the place. So it's hard to sort of quantify that in a meaningful way.
I guess a more general question I have with all of these questions I'm asking is that there's a behavioral effect and there's a fitness effect.
Yeah.
And how can you distinguish the two? That there's some behavior that is driven by fitness, but there is some behavior that is more driven by environment or just random community. I mean, in these experiments, can you really say that it's fitness that's driving them?
No. I mean, I can say that there's a fitness consequence.
Okay.
And so what I'm trying to show you is there's a fitness, there's a fitness consequence of being around males or being around males versus not being around males, and that changes as a function of the environment you do it in. So I'm only trying to say there's a consequence of it rather than saying what's driving it.
I find interesting that if I read it correctly, this graph, that the small females...
There's no in this plot there are no large and small females.
Ah, okay.
This is just, I'm just saying what's the effect of male harm. So if you just take, let's call them average size females and give them continuous exposure or minimal exposure to males, what's the effect of is there male harm? And the answer is yes, there is male harm. There's large male harm in vials and much lower male harm in these cages.
So this is a separate experiment?
This is a separate experiment. This is a separate experiment.
I mean, to come back to your question, if you run several times the experiment, then you should be able to tell the argument whether this is driven by environment or
through
the... if you run this experiment multiple times, right, you always see the same pattern. So there is truly a choice for males to go to larger females.
Yeah. So I mean, what I'm showing you right now is not experimental evolution, right? It's a single within a single generation assay.
So they always choose larger females.
Yes.
Whatever. It's not something that they've learned just this one time in this
That's right.
environment from other males, right?
That's right.
It's something that you can repeat, right? So I don't understand why you don't call it a sexually selected trait. I don't understand that.
I don't, because I mean, I'm tying sexual selection to something that occurs on males, and this is a selective difference between females. Well, if we want to not use the words of sexual selection, I can talk about, say, selection on the adult male phase and selection on the adult female phase. I'm happy to do that. So the whole point of this is there selection on the adult female phase, and it's changing in these different environments through the way males interact with those females. Yeah.
So there's also this language of sort of hard and soft selection, frequency dependence, which is actually a lot of why there's a distinction here, right?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, that's maybe a way.
Yeah.
This language.
I'm not sure I want to add an extra set of words, but I agree. Okay. So now we want to try and isolate this effect of male, the selection that results from male choice. And so we can do these experiments like the ones that Tristan Long and Bill Rice did, where we either do a no-choice trial, so you put males in a vial with either only large females or only small females, or you put males in where half females are one size and half of them are the other size. And you can do it in cages or in vials. And so we can look, this is results in terms of viability selection. This is viability in the adult stage. And you see this decline, significant decline in the strength of selection. This is selection against being small in vials. So this is consistent with the idea that males are preferentially harming and harassing those small females, and the large females reducing the selective difference between them in the vials when there's choice compared to when there's no choice. Here's fecundity, and there's no effect on fecundity. And then there's the data from the cages. So selection gets stronger in the cages, so it goes in the opposite direction. So when there's male choice, we get an increase in the strength of selection. So rather than the decrease of selection, we get the strengthening of selection on females in cages, which is the opposite to what is seen in vials. So in our study, combining viability and fecundity selection, we don't see a significant change in the vials, but we do in the cages, and it's opposite to what was previously seen in vials. Okay. So based on this, we would expect faster purging in cages than in vials, and really the right way to do this would be to do this sort of factorially with monogamy versus polygamy in cages and vials. That would be a logistic nightmare. So for this experiment, all we did was polygamy, but in cages versus vials, with the idea that we should see faster purging in the cages than we do in the vials. And so we looked at 22 gene disruption mutations, and we have three replicate populations for each one. We start them at a mutant frequency of 75% and track them for 10 generations. And this is what we see. And the solid lines are the complex, or those cage environments, and the open ones are the vials. And in 18 of the 22 cases, you end up with a final allele frequency that's lower in the complex environments than in the simple environments, which was consistent with what we were expecting.
Population size held constant?
Population size are held constant, and I can't remember what they were in this experiment, but it's on the order of 100 or 200 or something like that.
Strong selection.
Yeah. Right, so... faster purging in the cages than in the vials.
Did you change the amount of food available in the two?
Yes, the environments are different. When I call them complex and simple, that is the easiest way to talk about, but they are different in density, in the volume of them. They're different in the amount of food in them. They're different in I think the amount of live yeast is always, the way we're doing this, is quite abundant in all of them. So they're not different in that way.
That could be an alternative explanation, because you have more larval competition.
The larval competition is not part of this. So they compete in an adult arena, and then we have them lay eggs in vials and standardize the density.
Oh, okay. That's.
Yes, yeah, so the larval competition, it shouldn't be a part of this. They're only different.
It's just basically mating.
It's just during the adult phase that they're kept in these treatments, but other than that, they're kept the same. Sorry, I shouldn't have said that. So going back to these monogamy versus polygamy experiments, we want to see can we actually see this playing out differently if we treat them differently in the adult phase. When they're adapting to some different larval environment, which is the context that most of these previous experiments were done. So what we're going to do is we're going to put them in a new larval environment. In this case, it's cornstarch with a heat shock that occurs on day 4. And we're going to have the two classic treatments that previous experiments have had, so an enforced monogamy one and then polygamy in a vial. And then we'll add our new treatment, which is polygamy in a cage. And we're going to have seven replicate populations of each one. Population size is 280. So this is what the past experiments have done. We've added this third treatment. And then just to make sure there's nothing strange about the particular environment that they're adapting to, We've also repeated this experiment where they've adapted, instead of to this media, that larval media is this, or the larval media is that. So we have 63 total populations, so that's what I'll show you. So looking at larval viability, so this is where they're adapting to that salt environment. This is the ancestral viability in that environment. And here are the evolved lines from enforced monogamy and polygamy in a vial. And here are, for those other two environments, the sets of experiments that we've done. And what I like about this is if these results sort of recover, at least in spirit, what's seen in the literature. So in some cases, there's no difference between monogamy and polygamy. In some cases, there's a faster adaptation under polygamy. And in some cases, it's slower adaptation with polygamy. Those differences aren't significant, but at least in spirit, it's the same as what's seen in the literature. But when we do it in the complex environments, we see faster adaptation. The point estimate is always highest in these cages, and it's significantly faster in two of those three cases. Okay. So another way that you can that's sort of the adaptation story, at least what I think of as the adaptation story. You could also use this data or use these populations to look at purging. So if selection is stronger, then we'd expect deleterious mutations to be rarer. And probably the easiest way phenotypically to assay that is by looking at inbreeding depression. So we'd expect less inbreeding depression. This was the idea behind this recent paper in flower beetles, where they had lines that they had kept under with sexual selection and without sexual selection, these monogamy lines, and they did repeated inbreeding and looked at the rate of line loss through extinction.
So polyandrous means more males than females?
Yeah. In that case, I think that they had multiple males kept with a single female, allowing for the opportunity of sexual selection. So in these data, they do see this sort of what they interpret as evidence of sexual selection having purged out deleterious mutations. So when you do the inbreeding, you are less likely to lose lines than when you haven't done that. So that's a long experiment. We didn't do that experiment for, there's a couple reasons. One is time, but there's another reason that I probably won't get to why we didn't do it that way. But we looked just simply at inbreeding depression. And when you look at inbreeding depression, these are levels of inbreeding depression, and now we're assaying them all in the original environment, on the original food type, so it's not an adaptation story per se. And for all sets of these populations, we see that inbreeding depression is lower, often 50% or more lower than what it is in these other populations, suggesting that there's been more purging going on in when you keep them under these conditions than in these other conditions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have any idea of the actual distribution among the lines?
No. I mean,
for example, do you have some lines that actually maintain the ancestral?
Do you mean lines or populations? I've been using those terms loosely.
Or families.
Families, no, we don't have it at the family, definitely not at the family level.
So how do you measure in inbreeding depression here?
This is one generation of inbreeding, sort of full-sib mating, and we take offspring from full-sib mating and rear them with a competitor and outbred individuals and rear them with a competitor and replicate that a bunch of times.
For each. Measure fecality.
And then look at the number. So then you put a set number of eggs into a vial, and you're looking at the number of. This is just larval survival in breeding depression measure. Okay. So going back to this, why evolutionary biologists care about selection arising from sexual interactions, and I focus mostly on this second point, which is broader effects on adaptation and purging. But the other reason that historically people have cared about more is because of the actual traits involved in sexual interactions. And I want to turn to that for the last part. So everything I've told you about in this last section was focusing on the larval traits, larval survival, and what happens to adult fitness. So we can look at, we can do an assay looking for, at female fecundity. And now we have, this becomes a more difficult comparison because you have to think about the environment in which you're going to compare them, right? In the other case where we're looking at larval survival, that was always the same for all these populations. And so we had a sort of common way to compare them. Now we have three different ways we can compare them. We can look at the female fecundity. In this case, they're all with ancestral males. So by ancestral males, I mean males from the population that from which all these replicate populations were created. So female fecundity with ancestral males relative to a competitor female. And when you keep them under enforced monogamy conditions, you can also do that in do that same kind of assay under bile conditions and under container conditions. And the main point is we actually don't see very much interesting going on with female fecundity. The only pattern you see is that the females that evolved in these multi-fly containers do really well in the multi-fly containers, but there's really not much variation. This is all data from that one set of populations that evolved to that larval diet. Here's the data for all of them. And again, the only sort of real pattern is that the cage females do well in cage females, not surprisingly, but there's really not very much interesting variation amongst the other treatments. There's much more interesting information or more interesting patterns with respect to the males. To my knowledge, the very first monogamy versus polygamy experiment that was ever done wasn't done in this context of adaptation or purging, but was done in the context of looking at this idea of sexual conflict and sexual harm, and that was a classic study done by Brett Holland and Bill Rice. And we see some results that are similar to what they did. So if you look at males and how males perform under monogamy conditions, remember the only way a male is getting fitness in these conditions is by the output of the mate that he has been randomly assigned to. And so the idea here is that males that have evolved under monogamy, that now that selection that you were worried about of harming your mate, that should be reversed, right? Because you only have one mate, your fitness is completely tied to that mate, and so now you should be under pretty strong selection to not harm your mate. And so what we see is those monogamous females, or males from the monogamy treatment, do really well when you keep them under conditions of monogamy, but much better than those males from the polygamous treatment, who Bill showed harm and harass their mates to a much greater extent. If you do the male fitness assay and under bile conditions, you get a reversal there. So it's basically sort of a local adaptation story, right? You do well in the environment in which you evolve. And if you take those two classic treatments and assay them in a cage, the cage is kind of like a vial, and so the pattern you get is a similar pattern to what you see in a vial, but it's sort of the differences are muted. Okay, but to me the more interesting part of our experiment is, well, what happens for those males that have evolved in these complex containers? What do they do? Well, it turns out they do really well pretty much everywhere. They're better than vial males everywhere, including in vials, and they're better than monogamy males in containers, in vials. And the weird part we can't quite figure out is they seem to do as well or better even under conditions of monogamy. And we have some barely plausible ideas of why that might be.
But what is the assay under monogamy for?
You put a male under in, you randomly, or you take a male and you put him in a container with a single female, lives with that female for the 6 days, which is how in this experimental evolution we've always kept them 6 days in the adult phase.
Yeah.
And then at the end of that, if the female's dead, his fitness is zero. If the female's not dead, she gets to lay eggs for a 24-hour period, which is the standard period, and then you're counting the number.
You know how big are the population here?
All these populations are 280. Okay, so this is the end. I think intersexual interactions likely influence selection genome-wide. I've actually given you some evidence of that, so it's more me than just me thinking about that. This biased male harassment can severely weaken selection. I think that's something that people weren't thinking about until the last several years, but it can be, those effects can be massive. Many people have used monogamy versus polygamy as a manipulation of the presence or absence of sexual selection, which it certainly does these things, but it does a bunch of other stuff too. And I think people haven't been recognized or haven't been appreciating that. I think what I showed you was that the physical environment plays a key role in manipulating these male and female interactions, and as a consequence will have dramatic effects on how polygamy is affecting selection through females and probably also through males, although I haven't shown you direct evidence of that. And the physical environment is also playing a role in the particular phenotypes, sexual phenotypes that evolve in these cases, especially in males. We see these dramatic, as I was showing you on the last thing, these dramatic patterns with respect to males and less dramatic patterns with respect to females. And that's it. So thanks.
So did you try to measure drift in the three different treatments?
So we have some genomic data. We haven't really looked at it. I did just look at what heterozygosity levels were. They're the same. So there's no evidence that drift is much stronger in one than the others.
So that's that last result.
Whoops, sorry.
So in the cages, the males could be just getting more sperm, for example. And then under monogamy, just have more baby.
I don't think females are ever sperm limited. If that's what you
mean. As a correlated response through male-male competition.
Yeah.
Then over there you just get sperm without necessarily female.
But to me that would imply that in other scenarios that females are sperm limited under monogamy, if I understand your comment correctly. And I doubt that's the case. I mean, I don't have any evidence of that, but if you keep a male with a female, it seems unlikely to me that she would become sperm limited.
Well, it's a
relative. I guess we could test that by changing giving a female new males every
time. So it's sort of a relative concept. Whether or not
they're sperm. Sorry, I didn't follow that.
Since you give yes is at a fixed time.
Yeah.
The fact that they are sperm limited or not is sort of, that's the result.
Right.
They're sperm limited to 40 oocyte or 40 sperm.
Oh, I'm not sure I would say. I mean, you could have plenty of sperm and just be pumping out eggs at a lower rate.
Yeah.
Right. So, I can't conclusively say they weren't sperm limited in some way.
But I mean, the females don't change between those treatments.
That's right. In this assay, it's the same female, the ancestral female.
But I mean, but since you said the females could be pumping out eggs, but I mean, the difference between the A and C in your bottom left panel should not be ascribed to females, it should be ascribed to the male.
Yes, right? Absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
Did you look over time whether what could have evolved is the tendency basically to lay eggs? So it could be that, as far as I understood, this was done for one day. What would happen if you do it for day two, three, four? Would this also change between the treatments, or would it stay the same? Because it's, yeah.
So I certainly don't have the data to address that. I mean, in the course of the experiment, they have some set number of days to go from egg to adulthood. Then we collect adults, put them into their mating regimes, and they stay in their mating regimes for 6 days, and then they go into a new vial to lay it. Yeah, for one day.
That's what you were measuring.
Yeah, so that's what we're measuring. So we're measuring fitness as it would be realized in the context of this, under these experimental conditions.
The female fly stock is from the ancestral population.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So these are not co-evolved females.
None of these are co-evolved females, right? So I realize for the bacterial people, you'd like to see more data, but this is a massive, massive amount of...
That makes sense, because then you're really getting an accurate estimate of male fitness. It's against a common competitor.
So there's no coevolution story. There could potentially be an interesting coevolution story, but that would, of course, multiply this whole thing by...
I don't understand why you wouldn't do that.
No, but there's a simple way. Like, if you think for the this, what's this gene that Tracy has been, Chapman has been studying, this...
ACP.
Yeah, the ACP thing. It has multiple effects. Some effects harm the female, but it's known to stimulate egg production. So you could think that the ACPs or whatever are evolving in a way to optimize optimize fecundity of the female at day 7 when they're actually laying eggs.
Yeah.
So this could be something that you evolve a family egg, maybe this ACP or whatever you have, that they basically have different properties, because this is a complicated cleavage process, how they're interacting with each other. So it may be good eventually if the female is not immediately start laying eggs during the 6 days when they're mating, because this is useless, it will not contribute. So if you postpone this process and have them lay eggs later on, this could result in a higher fitness in the assay, because they contribute to the next generation, and therefore in this measurement of higher fecundity.
I think that certainly makes sense for the monogamy males. Anytime males are competing, I'm not sure evolution can sort of plan it to work that way, right? In the sense of...
If you have different ACP variants,
yeah.
then it's just the ones that basically say, if you have a variant that delays egg lay, will have basically a selective advantage in the next generation, because these females that had these ACPs
would be
more fecund.
I get it. It seems a very difficult. It seems a simple problem to solve under monogamy, right? You say, I'm going to mate with you on day one, or better yet, I'm just going to mate with you on day 6, and you're going to lay eggs on day 7, and I won't bother you until that time. But under polygamy, you mate with some female, you never know when some other male is going to mate with some female, and so getting that timing to work out in the way that you're suggesting.
The remating should be relatively low, so I think the remating rate is not very high.
I mean, I think that there's some story about what remating rate is, but I think if you go further into the literature, that story changes on exactly how you do these. Maybe.
But even with this polygamy, right? Do you ever watch the Olympic two-man cycling, where the two
they go
really, really slow for like 3 laps, and then right at the end they, because they only have to be first at the finish line.
Yeah.
Kind of like, so even under polygamy, it might not make sense to save your energy.
Yeah, I can't exclude.
If you know on day 7 you're gonna get the new environment.
Yeah.
May not be a deliberate decision, so it could just be developing slower or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the only thing I'm saying is it seems a much easier puzzle to sort of solve in a monogamy case than an evolutionary puzzle than getting those variants to work out and having the right kind of variation in a polygamy case. Okay, thank you.